Almost Perfect Podcast.
Welcome to the Almost Perfect Podcast, celebration of fuck-ups, failures, and falling flat on your face. This is a podcast that believes you can learn from experience, but that experience doesn't have to be your own. Ha, I'm but perfect, and I'm a functional fuck-up. As I'm from somebody else's mistakes, and today we are learning from Italia Chana. Now, Italia is an actor. Well, I know her as an actor, although she started out as a writer and is now a director, has been a dancer, and is an artiste in all the ways someone is an artist, a true artist in many ways, and someone who creates from quite an emotional space. So this is a very interesting chat. We get into her treasure chest of trauma that she utilizes as an actor. We talk about acting and storytelling as vehicles for healing, as vehicles for self-discovery, and for, you know, processing shit that's happened to you, processing life, and recreating that for other people to enjoy. We get into her growth, we get into why she creates now, we find out just how resourceful and tenacious she is. So this is quite a great chat. I really enjoyed it, and I know you are going to too. I need to let you know, of course, that this is a podcast that is brought to you by you. That means you can support it by going to patreon.com/almostperfect. You can also buy a mug from me. They're 100 rand each, plus shipping, which is like 100 bucks. I do postnet to postnet, which is 99 rand. So 200 bucks total, unless you can get it from me in Durban. And yeah, man. A 10 rand from each sale goes to Sasonke. Sasonke is an organization by sex workers for sex workers who are working to decriminalize sex work. And you can check them out over at sasonke.org.za. So yeah, that's what's got coming up. That's some of the housekeeping that I got to get out the way. But yeah, I'm back home. Some of you know I've been in Joburg helping my mom move into her and my grand's new place. And it was cool, like, getting to hang with my mom and see her again after such a long time. And, you know, be of service, help out, do the things, be a good son. And I got to see a friend as well. We watched The Suicide Squad together, which was really good. I mean, it's James Gunn, so no surprises there. Really good cast, fucking well written, you know, just very creative, lots of surprises. Kept you on the edge of your seat, kept you on your toes, like the Suicide Squad should, you know? I know I've been like, oh, superhero movies, whack. Well, not really whack, but, you know, kind of boring, kind of like just overwhelmed by all of it. Just like there's just so many, and there's so many other cool stories out there and so many other cool movies out there. But I think the Suicide Squad was good. I think it was really good and probably one of the best comic book movies I've seen. So if you haven't seen that yet, go check that out. What else? This is going to be a bit of a pop culture one because I am super pumped. I'm going to be getting up at Hoppers 3 on Saturday morning because CM Punk is returning to wrestling. He was coming to AEW. Well, it's like 99% certain. There's like just been all the hints in the world. They built it up really well. They're doing it at Chicago, which is his hometown. And yeah, as a wrestling fan and as someone who's been watching AEW since before day one, it's really fucking... I don't know, man, this is like my Avengers Endgame, you know, this is just like the pinnacle of like years of build-up and potential and wondering what would happen, and now we get to see what happens. They've also got Bryan Danielson or Daniel Bryan coming along soon, and just in general have such a dope roster, have been telling great stories for so long, and now they're bringing basically one of my favorite wrestlers ever into the company. So I feel like it's going to be a moment. I'm keen to be on the internet for it. I'm keen to be in some wrestling forums and seeing. Yeah, I'm on wrestling forums. That's how much I dig this shit. And I'm super pumped to be a part of that experience and see what happens. So if you're awake at like 4 a.m. on Saturday, follow me on Twitter, almostperfectza. What else? Yeah, slightly bigger news, just slightly more important. We're getting vaccinated, motherfuckers! Yeah, man! Yeah! Oh, shit, I am so fucking happy. By the time you're hearing this, I should be walking up to Musgrave. I think there's a vaccination site there as far as I remember. So I'm going to upload this thing and do the tweets, bust the vibes, and then hit my walk and hopefully manage to get vaccinated later today. So it's a lot. It's a lot to think about. It's going to be quite an experience. I'm definitely going to be emotional about it for a lot of different fucking reasons. Obviously, a lot of us have lost friends and family members and have contracted the virus ourselves and dealt with that whole experience. So having some protection, having quite a decent amount of protection against the virus now will be pretty fucking helpful. And I am going to be doing shows. I have mentioned that on various social media, and I think I've mentioned it on podcasts before. You are going to have to show that you're vaccinated if you want to come to the shows. And you're also going to have to wear masks inside. Because, yeah, I'm going to be that guy that's overcautious. But I'd rather be overcautious and do the thing properly and try my absolute hardest, you know, to make sure that people can't get COVID if they come and watch me perform comedy. Like, it would be pointless to have taken all this time off and to not do the thing and then just try and go back to the same old thing immediately. So yeah, that's how I'm gonna do it. I've got some venues in mind. I also, like, well, in Durban, I'm not too sure about other cities. So if you're in another city and you've got a venue, or you're a comedian and you want to perform with me, let me know. bob@almostperfect.co.nz, or if you've got a cool venue that you think I should hit up myself, let me know. I'm keen to travel a little. I want to test out a lot of material because, yeah, it's been a while. So I need to get quite a few shows under my belt. And then the plan is to then tour the end of the world for a bit. Well, it's not the end of the world is what I'm going to be calling it. And yeah, that's a completely different show, but also some of the same jokes from what it was. So, but I mean, I only performed that once, so you wouldn't even know what those jokes are. So yeah, we're about to embark on the journey of trying to put a one-man show together in the post-pandemic vibe, and touching on a lot of things that, it's weird, man. I was fairly prescient with that show, so we'll see how it goes now that a lot of the stuff I was talking about is now, you know, stuff that's happened in some cases. Because, like, I was talking about zombie outbreaks and I wasn't expecting this. And a lot of what's happened now, I don't know, it makes me rethink about the whole zombie outbreak thing. Like, I'm not too certain people would try to avoid the zombies. And I know other people have mentioned that as jokes. So don't worry, that's not my hook. It's not my vibe. I'm just saying that, yeah, it has definitely made me rethink things. Speaking of stand-up comedy, I watched Pete Davidson's Alive from New York. I've actually been watching a lot of comedy this week. But that one was probably the best one that I've seen this week. And some people might be like, what? But yeah, I think it was pretty good. Like, there were some weak moments and you could tell he was struggling at points. But at the same time, I really enjoyed the opener for sure. And yeah, good show. He touches on his life. Like, he does the things you're meant to kind of do as a modern comedian, where you draw on your own experiences and you extort the pain for laughs. And he does that quite well. So I enjoyed that show. I'm very keen to see where he goes as a comedian. I think he's got a lot of room to grow. But yeah, he's really good at the moment. I mean, it's ironic me saying that, but I'm saying that as a critic, you know, not as a comedian. Like, I don't know where I'm at on the ladder. It's a little bit below Pete Davidson. Just a smidgen. And yeah, so That's the intro stuff. I had notes. Those are all the notes out of the way, which means I'm going to give the shout out. And yeah, man, over at patreon.com/almostperfect, there is a tier. It is called the titular titles tier, and it is a $10 tier. Now, this is the top tier. Over at patreon.com/almostperfect. Did I say that twice? Yes, I did. I'm going to keep saying it because that's where you need to be so that I can eat. And also so you can keep enjoying this podcast. And I'm not going to guilt trip you the way I guilt tripped my Instagram followers this week. I did a meme strike. Because if you follow me on Instagram, you know I share a lot of memes in the stories. And yeah, I did a meme strike. Until I got to 150 subscribers on YouTube, I was dishing out memes one subscriber at a time. I only lost 2 followers on Instagram and I gained about 20 subscribers on YouTube. So I'm going to say the strike worked. We killed 2 birds with 1 stone there, got rid of shitty people, and also onboarded rad people. So life is good there. But if you want to be rad, you want to be radder than those people. If you want to extend this parasocial relationship and get money involved, then you can head on over to patreon.com/almostperfect. Where, like I said, we've got the titular titles tier. Now, these are the people who are a part of the cast and crew, right here at Almost Perfect Media. They are the people who make it possible, along with some underlings whose names get put out over on youtube.com/C/AlmostPerfectMedia, probably. Don't have it in front of me. Anyway, it's the shout-outs time. It's the shout-outs. I know I'm rambling. Shout-outs to Riz Ventura, who is the director of purchasing. Shout-outs to our executive producer, of course, that is Stephen Olafia. Shout-outs to Rousseau, our chief sales officer of Subtle Heresies in the greater Oberberg region. Shout-outs to Tyron Love, who is our pantsless weasel. Shout-outs to Karan Snemman, who is the Almost Perfect hedge fund manager. Shout-outs to Vishendra Naidu, our spiritual advisor. Shout-outs to our assistant to the regional manager, that is Karan Chetty. Shout-outs to Neil Green, who is the key grip. Shout-outs to Kath Jenkin, the inevitable ruler of the universe, and Queen Swifty. Shout-outs to our king, that is Julian. And lastly, shout-outs to our anonymous benefactor. I don't know what the clue should be. Like, there's no clue this week. Go listen to the other intros, try figure it out. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go listen to the other intros, try and figure it out. That is kind of everything I need to tell you. One last thing. Last week I said that Alan Watts definitely didn't say that there is no future. That's a lie. Of course Alan Watts said there is no future. That's very much what he says. Like, you know, you only have right now, you only have today, tomorrow, like, never comes. It can never exist. It's only a metaphysical concept. Did I just misuse the word metaphysical? 100% I did. But that doesn't matter, because here comes the Almost Perfect Podcast with Italia Chana. So how are you living, Italia?
How am I living? Yes. I'm living gently, as mindfully as I can be. You know, it's been a year and a half of adjustments in the pandemic, and... You know, certain ways my life has changed, just the way I'm living has really been, you know, an integration with outdoor exercise, gentle exercise, walking. And I think that's affected my mindfulness a lot. And, you know, with the risks of being indoors and in social spaces and bars and drinking, my social time is far turned into coffees and, you know, keep my eye on that 10K step count in the parks in Johannesburg, because the city is a city.
Well, it sounds like you have had a very healthy pandemic, if I can put it that way.
Well, thankfully, I can be thankful for my health.
Well, I mean mentally and physically, because, yeah, all of that sounds like, you know, a good path to wellness in general.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting to consider what wellness is under circumstances of general duress, you know, financial duress, businesses up and down, industries up and down, all of the threat we have to illness, everyone at all times. So the anxiety that holds, a different threat, you know, the neurosis, how do we incorporate the realities of a viral pandemic while, you know, still living and striking some kind of balance and not withdrawing too much. But, you know, meanwhile, we're in a surge of social and familial grief such that we've never lived or known before, which is wild, inconceivable, and we're still needing to survive. And, you know, so that toll on mental health, or the expectations, perhaps pre-pandemic, as people and especially as artists, where so much energy is going into the machine of creating and making and pursuing opportunities, opportunities to collaborate, platforms to exhibit work on. Everything has slowed down and become more gentle, yet in another way, there's a different kind of momentum. I suppose a year and a half into the pandemic, you know, it becomes life, right? We are all living.
Yeah. Yeah, I think especially for our generation, we haven't had to deal with loss on this scale like ever. And
absolutely.
Even in wars, it was kind of still different. I mean, that was, in my mind, very horrific. And I don't know what I would pick, but I'm, you know, dealing with what we've got. And it's been an adjustment, like, you know, just coming to terms with that, with mortality, and coming to terms with the whole thing of like, you really do only have today. But the problem is, I got to spend today indoors so that I can, you know, hopefully have it tomorrow. So it's always like these weird, like, things going on in your brain, like every single fucking day for like nearly 2 years now. So at times I've definitely withdrawn. I'll say that much. Like, there's been periods where it's like I've been Bo Burnham inside, like growing out that facial hair, like living like a hermit. So I also have had the other side of it where sometimes, you know, I'm doing yoga and I'm going for walks in the park. So I don't know. I think it's an ebb and flow at the moment. Hey?
It's such an ebb and flow. You know, I think time is, as a construct that we perhaps used to take for granted or were conditioned to understand, especially in a high-functioning metropolitan cities, the shape, the construct of time is different when our exposures and stimulations have changed so much. You know, I was really appreciating what you were saying about the power of the present moment, because the ephemerality of life, of loved ones, of families is so with us. And the need, you know, the striking, humbling, nuanced need to be able to express I love you. You know, what are some of the teachings and the takeaways from this is to tell people I love you. When you love someone, say I love you. And, you know, share that safety, that security, because truly what we used to take for granted, we kind of can't anymore. And that ebb and the flow of how indoors we can be, you know, the great risk of withdrawing, you know, completely, having a challenge to reemerge, you know, with vaccines at the moment, Bob, I don't know if you've come across this phrase, post-pandemic emergence paralysis or phobia.
I've seen some stuff about it.
Yeah, so this is really like piquing my interest, and it's a bit of a character backdrop and a psychological state or response, threat response, that I'm exploring through a character in my next short film that I'm developing at the moment. But you know, I'm really interested, especially in cities and countries like our own in South Africa, where you know, parts of the population wish to be vaccinated, other parts don't wish to be vaccinated. We're not in some accelerated pursuit of being a vaccinated nation. This is not going to be a reality for us. And, you know, even the growing awareness for other countries and cities that are, you know, San Francisco, last I heard, they were like 75% vaccinated. Maybe now they're 82% vaccinated. You know, even the realities faced there with the continued mutations, the coronavirus is still here for the next little while. Being fully vaccinated doesn't mean that our guards can get lowered, that, you know, our socialization can resume as we knew it, and that the gap, the cleft between who we think we are from our past experience before the pandemic, you know, the kinds of levels of stimulation, social interaction, pleasure, touch, alcohol, right? For us in the country where recurringly it's banned, you know, versus on the other side of the gap, 2 years into a pandemic, you know, who we really are, what we really need, and how we, almost in conversation with our own self, can adjust our expectations. And, you know, we keep saying it, right? Slow down, move gently, make these adjustments so that, you know, maybe we do integrate what it is we've learned, what have been the teachings of this extraordinary introspection that our lifetimes have never, ever offered us before.
Yeah, it comes at a great cost, but I agree with you there that this last year and a bit has really allowed me to come to terms with myself and who I am. You know, like I have a far greater understanding of who I really am versus who I was trying to project, you know? And like, I'm still coming to terms with that. And the reemergence into society, and especially as an artist, as a stand-up comedian, like, I'm a different person now. So the art I'm going to be creating is going to be different to what I was putting out, you know, before the pandemic, and trying to adjust to that and trying to figure out exactly what that means has been both difficult and it's sometimes really easy, because it's like, well, I know I don't want that, you know? So have you had those kinds of moments as an artist? Because you're someone who's always creating. Like from what I see, you're either working on something of your own or you're working on something of someone else's all the time. So how do you, you know, figure out who you are and all of that?
You know, what a fascinating question. And honestly, Bob, what a privilege it is to be an actor. And to have been acting in this time. You know, you were speaking about like the confronting, the aligning, the questioning of these projections of ourselves. The process of acting, taking on a character, whomever it is so extraordinary, and it's such a gift. And, you know, I'm intrigued as to how, you know, the process of comedy as well always connects binaries, right? The binary, yep. Right, of comedy, humor. We're living in, perhaps I might say, a humorless time, and the need for laughter, for jokes, for a lighthearted spin on just crazy atrocities we're living through is more needed than ever.
I feel it's the opposite, though. Like, I feel like humor has just got nihilistic. Like, it's still there. It's just not like as uplifting and motivating as it might have been at one point in time.
You know, and that's such a precious thing, Bob, because I really, as a writer, I've always been very fascinated by the line, you know, and please, you'll reflect better on this than me, but the line between depression, mental health, wellness, and humor, right? And yeah. Jokes. but in terms of process of acting and working and, you know, stripping and interrogating who one is, my recent opportunities, you know, and I think something that I truly value about the career I'm experiencing and the roles that I'm experiencing is, you know, I play characters rather a lot younger than me, and so as an older young adult woman, but an older woman compared to a younger woman, but rather a teenage girl at different points in teenagehood, you know, it's such an extraordinary informative, transformative period of life. I know my teenagehood, my girlhood really was for me, I think, tapestries of, you know, trauma from different points in life, but from early experiences, were really a tangible response. And, you know, with these roles, I'm able to revisit and reintegrate different times of my life. And it's truly a gift to be able to inhabit and recount and rewrite, you know, synapses of your own narrative, if one could say, when we're pretending, when we're performing, when we do role play, and this is a therapeutic experience. It can be a therapeutic process. Role play is part of therapy rooms. Role play is indeed part of healthy sex lives for people who are into that. You know, there is you know, maybe something neurally going on as well that's allowing us to explore, make peace, and retell our own stories.
Yeah, that's something I've picked up about actors in, like, listening to actors talk about acting a lot of the time, especially through Marc Maron's podcast. And it's that whole thing of, in a weird way, you're not necessarily reliving your life, but at the same time, you're always drawing from your own life in these moments that are on screen. And I've always wondered, like, what is that like to actually be that vulnerable in front of a camera and to relive these experiences? Because also you've been in some movies that are pretty, like, they deal with some heavy stuff, you know?
So, Bob, the truth about heaviness is that it's heavy and really, really tender, you know? And some of the more recent heavy drama work I've done, you know, I've started to refer to my treasure chest of trauma, and as days and weeks of production may go on and you re-inhabit and recreate incredibly emotional moments drawing from your own memories, and set is so wild, you know, things can go wrong and suddenly you're shooting a scene for reasons, you know, that only the gods of cinema battery packs know for 3 hours. And, you know, you're wondering, how do I sustain this emotional state? And these journeys go, and it's exhausting. But, you know, I found myself, I was portraying, so in the film, the scene was the funeral of my loved one. And I was 16 years old. I was giving a eulogy. And the cinema gods busted out that camera, and we had to go on a kind of extraordinarily lengthy journey to cover this funeral scene. And to sustain, you know, it's not even pretty, man. Like, to sustain that, I was extraordinary. And this is just extraordinary for me, you know, that this even happened. But I was just, I recreated mentally through sights, smells, touch, the memory of people's clothes and spaces. I transported myself in a mental three-dimensional world to one of the most poignant funerals. Seems like I'm transporting myself now that I ever attended in my life. Most transformative, which was the funeral of my childhood best friend. Great sentence to end the funeral of my childhood. And, you know, on the one, you know, just what the human mind can do in the name of an artistic pursuit, you know, when motivated to do so, it's just extraordinary. And of course, it's exhausting, Bob, you know, heavy roles, yeah. Drama roles. You know, day after day, I remember as the weeks wore on of this production, this character was going through a lot, let me tell you. And I kept opening what I call this treasure chest of my traumas. And as the weeks wore on, it got harder. You know, I was noticing this almost split in my projected personality or my behavioral personality. When I was not shooting, I was almost like childlike. I was inhabiting naivety, and insiders would get closer to shooting and knowing what I would have to do, what I would need to open, what the scene required. There would be this resistance. I don't want to remember certain things in such acute emotional detail, such that it is embodied, right?
Yeah.
Yet, as an actor, as an artist, to be able to do that is phenomenal, and it truly is a gift, and it is incredibly rewarding, while also being alienating. Alienating in some ways from one's own life, one's own relationships as you knew it or as they knew you before, suddenly day after day for 12, maybe 14 extended day hours, 16 day hours, one is sort of enduring a roller coaster. You know, we do change. And I guess this is why the need for de-rolling is so important, so that we shed what isn't ours and that we practice shedding what isn't ours to continue to carry now, lest we allow our past selves, to take too much hold in our present, and lest our past selves get into the driver's seat of our present life.
Yeah.
But so, you know, in contrast, right, I recently had a wonderful opportunity to play just such a delightful character. The drama was never hers. In so many ways, she was the lighthearted, bubbly relief. And it was just a joy, Bob, to not have to open that treasure chest.
And that's kind of like how I like see you in my mind, like from my brief interactions with you, is like, you know, a bit more bubbly and a bit more fun. And But actually, what I wanted to ask just now was essentially, how do you shed roles and how long does that process usually take? And do some roles take longer to shed than others?
What an interesting question. Some roles do take longer to shed. And I think this depends on what the actor or the person or me, whomever, has had to give up for that role. Okay. You know, there are many different methods. You know, acting, the experience of relaying an authentic human condition and story is different. There are many different ways to do it. Myself, I lean into the method approach in a bit more of an intuitive, unstructured way, having never gone to method acting school or anything like that. But, you know, when one's dealing with perhaps spiritual narratives that the actor makes choices, perhaps it's foods to cut out of the diet. Perhaps it is sex to cut out of the actor's vessel, the body's life, for the duration of the role. You know, the process of return, you know, perhaps...
And that's not just a sacrifice for you. Like, if you have a partner, that's a two-way sacrifice.
Absolutely. And, you know, one certainly does not want... Nobody in any field wants their work coming home with them, right? And wreaking havoc in their own house. But it is. It's absolutely a sacrifice for a partner to make. But perhaps it doesn't have to be looked at as sacrifice, right? If one is exploring rich tapestry of life, philosophy, if the body is the vessel, it's sort of, you know, narratives are crazy, right? We, you know, the process of suspending our disbelief, which is what any of us do as audience members, you know, in a movie, watching a series, and perhaps, you know, we suspend our disbelief in so many other ways. When our friend is telling us a gripping story and, you know, this one's a transformative one and we're going in all directions and then there's the U-turn and we're left and now we're doing a donut and the story has meant a great deal to them, effectively. You know, when we are listening and witnessing, are we not also suspending our disbelief? But yes, sacrifices are made. And you know, roles can be something that that is endured. You know, there are certain mental states one has to endure to continue to maintain whatever if we look at acting or a character's emotional score as a musical composition, to maintain that note. And, you know, I can't pretend in my relationships, in my life so far, I haven't found it alienating sometimes. I've certainly found it difficult to return, you know, and it's also, it's more than just you and the character, right? If you're out shooting on location for weeks, you know, the whole world might be in a pandemic, right? And you're in this closed bubble, and you're so remote from anywhere, you know, you're not even entering garages to buy airtime or chocolates. That's just not what's happening. You don't even use money or touch money or engage in trade for weeks. And then you return to the world and, you know, you return to the city, you return to your own street. You need to buy airtime. You go to the garage to spend money. This is also like these crazy culture shocks. I remember coming back from 3 weeks away in Sebokeng for a production last year. And I came back to Johannesburg in slip-slops, shorts, and a t-shirt, and I had to buy airtime. And it was nighttime, and the street, it was also, well, it wasn't just any night. This was Melville, okay? This is where I was. This is where I got dropped. This was my pickup point. It was Melville on a Thursday night. No one's wearing slops. No one's wearing shorts. No one's wearing a t-shirt. No one's sad. Feet are sandy. And yeah, it's just wild, I suppose. What is it? Humans are so adaptable. Maybe that's what I'm getting at. We readapt back, but we do adapt to other worlds.
Yeah, that's fucking so true. Like, just from everything I've learned, and we can get into some very different states and a lot of, like, depending on the, you know, the reasons behind it. But what I want to actually get into is, how did you get into acting? How did you get into film? How did you get into all of this? What is the starting point in your mind?
Oh, what a precious, precious question anyone could ever ask me. It's going to take me to fun memories and, you know, things in some ways we've touched on already. I was born into a very loving, very precious family of researchers, academics. scientists. There's always been artistic appreciation and a high value for art. But my parents are both public health researchers. My early years were spent living in Bushbuck Ridge in Mpumalanga. I was born in Limpopo. Moved around a little bit, and then we moved to Johannesburg for me to properly start schooling. And when I went to school, I made my best friend, you know, my best friend of primary school. And this is the same friend who later took her life and was at this funeral. And, you know, I didn't just meet my friend. I met her family, you know, and you know what it's like with the kids you grow up with. You know, their moms become your moms, and you're all in and out of each other's houses, going away together, spending the weekend together, and all of that. And there was just more of a literary pursuit in this family, you know. And I think for me, I was just exposed to art for the first time. And, you know, in school, I was led into the cultural activities, plays, writing. And I remember in grade two, we had a task saying in grade two, my class, her name was Mrs. Frank. And we had to draw a picture of who what we wanted to be when we grew up. And at this point, I think I'd been forever changed by this friend of mine. But yet I drew the most boring image. It was all stick figure, but I basically drew a person sitting at a table, much like I am right now. And I wrote, you know, in my terribly bad 8-year-old handwriting, writer. And I think that is when I committed to a life in the arts. But, you know, you also asked me, Bob, how did I bring myself all the way around to film? And that's another story. I actually ended up on a trajectory of dance.
Oh, wow. Well, I can kind of tell by your Instagram that you've got a bit of a dance history, but I didn't realize it was that. So I didn't even realize that writer was the first pursuit. I would have, like, you know, because I don't know you that well. Like, we've chatted a little bit in real life and then a bit on the internet. So I'm getting to know you. And I assumed it was the, you know, being an actor and then wanting to write that came that way. So it was actually writing and then everything else.
Absolutely. And I think I'll always be that way. It's always to people's great surprise, but I'm very reserved and very introverted person. And so I think naturally, writing for me is kind of always where story starts. But yet, you know, story is story, right? So my career as a dancer was cut short when I was in a terribly bad accident and my hip broke, and now, you know, extensive surgery. I was in a hospital for a number of weeks. I was then for a number of months an outpatient. Rehabilitating, I had to learn how to walk again. I had to learn how to sit up by myself again. I had to, you know, it was just a crazy experience of, as a young adult, bursting out of the wings onto the stage, into her career, into her life, being made infantile again. You know, I was utterly dependent as if an infant, when I couldn't walk, when I couldn't bathe myself, when I could hardly feed myself. And, you know, as these things so often and so tragically go, you know, what comes out of a surgeon's mouth to any young person is the farthest thing from what they want to say. And these were the words, "You'll never dance again." Mm-hmm. And it took me a little while. I'm a bit stubborn like my grandmother. So I really tried to dance again, Bob, to the point of giving myself some injuries. And, you know, I guess everyone's got a journey of what it takes to accept great loss, right? And change. Yeah. And there's nothing I regret and there's nothing I change about what it is that I do now. It's reapplying all the same faculties. And there was a moment where I just thought, I want to work in film. I want to make films. I want to be in films. I want to be part of film. And I back then called Google my best friend, because this is when I started teaching myself screenwriting on Google. And Google really did the things.
That's how I did it.
It really taught me how to write screenplay.
I took a course on Coursera on how to write a sitcom. And then ever since then, it's just been downloading other people's scripts and watching YouTube videos.
It's amazing what we can really access to grow ourselves and change ourselves online.
No, 100%. I mean, you call Google your best friend. Like, I studied at the University of YouTube. Like, that's
love that.
Like, that's the honest truth. Like, this podcast is like, will sound the way it sounds because of YouTube, like, because of all the tutorials and everything. But you learned how to screenwrite, and then how did you actually start getting into films?
I had a sort of slowly over the years, you know, my journey's been non-linear. Slowly over the years, I had a different sort of mentorship or incubation opportunities with the NFVF, the National Film and Video Foundation, who really are out, you know, doing the work to bring opportunity to develop voices, and also to do so outside of the university structure, which I think is amazing. Before that, or in my early years after the accident, you know, what I did get into was, let's call it the broken body, no pun intended whatsoever. And I got into making performance artwork, and I started to make performance art films. And these were all sort of once-off shows that were narrative-based, but abstract, no dialogue or anything. They were expressed through the body of what it was. Broken dance. It was what could my body do now that it is broken? What does it look like? Because it certainly doesn't move the same. And what I got into, you know, I suppose I probably had started Googling how to write a screenplay, and then I probably threw in a For Dummies at the end, you know, screenplay 101. And I got really into genre films. And so these narratives were, I would start building short films, and, you know, my casts were growing from one, just me, to two, to five, as I was creating these works around Johannesburg for different festivals and galleries. And I started to run film sets for these once-off performances.
But what do you mean, like, you just started doing this? Like, what do you mean? Like, you're telling me you can just start doing it and people will, like, you approach them and you say, hey, I've got some films. Like, how does this all work? Because, like, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's busy going, what do you mean you just did it?
You know, great question, Bob. And let me tell you, and I'm sure everyone's going to relate to this, certainly didn't feel like I just did it. But I suppose just doing it, right? What does that mean? The way that I was just doing it then was, you know, whatever budget there was from the galleries, you know, we'd use to create a bolder design. So design is intrinsically a part of my work.
To break it down a little bit further there, how did you approach the galleries and stuff? Like, some actionable advice for people who want to try to do these sorts of things.
Okay. So the first thing, right, is create a performance and invite galleries to watch it. So if you are a university student in some type of way and there is a showcase, don't just showcase and get your grades. Invite people in the industry or in the field to watch you. Also, and or film it. Film the crap out of it. Get some friends, get some people from the film school, get one camera to cover it, so that if no one shows up to your event, or if only one people show up, so it's documented, so that you can create a package and email yourself out. And then allow one thing to lead to another. I think in a few ways I almost was a resident for a gallery I invited to my first broken body performance, the very first time I ever moved, created a dance, and it after the accident. And it was very much about rebirth. And I guess in so many ways, I look at myself in my mind's eye, like the, you know, like the image of a calf who's just been born and is trying to stand on their spindly legs. But that's a great place to start, is create. So also, you cannot wait for a green light. Create something documented. I like that. If you are looking for opportunity, believe me, there are people like-minded, kindred spirits, artistic spirits who want to work with you, who are also looking to create, who are going to love what you do, who are going to love your mind, who are going to approach you. And that's sort of what happened to me. So I had my first couple of early ones, and a wonderful collaborator, who I certainly hope an ongoing collaborator of mine will continue to be. He goes by Dobili Goalad Dobie, if I've got it all right, on Instagram, but a multimedia artist named Kopano Lechaba, also known as Dobie. And he approached me at an event and was like, you know, I saw you perform, and whatever you're doing, I want to, like, do it. I want to be a part of it. I don't know how, I don't know what. You're going to tell me what it is. What is the thing we're next doing? And, you know, we further explored. What he's interested in is post-production. What did we do? We got a camera. Who did we meet? Someone else with another camera. Who did they know? A third person with another camera. What happened? Okay, cool. Galleries were getting more familiar with me. The next show, like I said, the cast evolved. Called up another guy I knew who was just spectacular, had a spectacular, very unique style of movement. And I called up these guys, and you know, what were they? I thought of it like a happening. Absolutely. It's ephemeral. It's not structured. I never went to film school. Don't think any of these guys went to film school either. I created lighting with what we had. There was a point in the show where a gentleman, a bourgeoisie, who would work with me on my designs, was flashing a flashlight to create that sort of throbbing. It was our, there's a word for that light. But, you know, we filmed it, you know. What did we have? Multiple angles. What was going on? An artwork. There was a live audience. We were not retaking anything. It was a fluid moment. It was narrative, though. This particular experimental film I'm thinking about is my work called Revolver. It was a film noir. What did we do with this footage? Well, we went into post-production on a laptop that could barely cope with Premiere Pro, but it managed.
You're reminding me of my early days with Durban Is Yours, working on a laptop that I made the mistake of skateboarding with a laptop in my bag, and it smashed into the ground, and I had to like duct tape it back together and run an operating system off of a flash drive. And for like the first year of Durban Is Yours, that's how it was run. So
that's how you worked, because there is no giving up, right? There is no giving up. And, you know, unless we die, you know, then we're not faced with the choice to get back up. But I do believe there's no giving up, because even if we think we do, a few years later, 2 years later, some weeks down the line, you know, we can't give up. We've got to keep going. But, you know, what you were doing then, Bob, just like you asked me, well, how are you doing it? You were doing, right?
Yeah.
No one gave you money to fix your laptop, but it worked. Yeah, no, nobody did. And, you know, it's a big thing. Like, you know, when no one's giving you money, right? How do we do things? You know, we do things with other people. We collaborate. People want to do things too. And, you know, so I guess that was my origination in film. And I don't think I quite yet knew that I wanted to, I don't think I ever thought I would direct my own first film. That was a big surprise for me.
Well, let's actually get into that. So is Thorns your first film?
Yes. Thorns, a 24-minute art house drama.
That featured on SABC. So how did that happen?
So this is wonderful. And for any woman listening, the NFVF, whom I mentioned before, do run an annual cycle called the Female Filmmakers Lab. This is an incubator for women voices, writer directors, to pitch a 24-minute short film idea, to get selected to receive mentorship through excellent script editors, and to write a film in an incubated process. And then, you know, then we pitch, right? So you also pitch to get in the program if you're shortlisted. So it's an incubator. It's not film school you're doing, right? And then you pitch again, and there's a selection to direct. And, you know, when that time came around, I wanted to direct this film. I was terrified. You know, even when it came to pitching, I was terrified. My imposter syndrome was just through the roof, you know. Who am I? And that acute awareness of, you know, why did I want to direct this so badly? Why did I want to direct so bad? I really wanted to learn something, right? I really wanted to do something I'd never done before. The crazy part is that when I actually did it, and I think I was only able to accept it the night before my shoot day one. By that, I mean strip myself of this imposter syndrome and a belief that there was something I was missing, having, you know, not gone to film school, not knowing the jargon, not being that technical person or that technical director on set.
But if you've got a good DP, they know what you mean when you say, make it look a little squiggly there.
You know, my favorite sentence starts with, I want it to feel like this. we're going to look at this part, we're going to look at this prop at this moment, and then we're going to, and you know, that's truly it, right? It's storytelling. And at the end of the day, this any emphasis on a particular Bible of lingo, you know, everyone also speaks different lingo. One DOP's, you know, shot is another DOP's, you know, foreign language. So yeah, that was amazing, you know, to realize actually with all those things I've done, you know, I've actually done this before. I've always been doing this. I've always been creating a mise-en-scene, creating a performance, directing the story and the actors, dressing the people, placing the props, covering it in whatever way with cameras. And then, you know, the credits roll. So that was the funny part, coming full circle, was realizing, hang on, I've been doing this. This is what I've been doing. This is actually exactly what I've been doing.
As a director, how much have you learned from, you know, being an actor? Because you're saying you actually, this is what you do, you know, like even when you're not the director, these are all things and choices you're making, I guess, in your own mind as you're playing out the scenes and that. And I assume your first big film would have been Necktie Youth, or am I wrong there?
Yes, that was my first feature.
That was your first feature. And like, what, okay, so actually what I want to chat about with that first, and then we'll get into other stuff, is with that film, what was the feeling about it like, you know, amongst all of you who created it? Because I remember watching it at the Durban International Film Festival and being like, fuck yeah, this is great. You know, I really, really enjoyed it. I loved the acting. I loved the writing. It was like something, you know, a lot of people have said it's like kids, and yes, it is like kids, but it's also its own South African thing. So what did you guys think you were creating?
Oh, you know, Bob, again, what a precious question to ask me that'll take me all the way to precious memories of mine. Yeah, the energy, the air, what did we think we were creating? What were we a part of? What was the director, Siv Shongwe-Lame, creating? Was a kids, was a Joburg sub-culty, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll kind of themed youth culture, subculture film, exploring mental health issues, exploring privilege, access, decentralization and marginalization, you know, exploring wastefulness, right? In a youth landscape. And, you know, what's precious for me about this memory, and, you know, you're saying, well, what were you a part of? What was it for you? Well, for me, you know, the director and I go way, way, way back into early teenagehood. And this connection point between, you know, the death of my best friend growing up, and the origination or the birth or the spark in some ways of this film and this story is one and the same. As Necktie Youth does sort of spark off with the social ramifications and world affected by a young woman who takes her life. Yeah. So again, a precious, what do we say when film reflects life in some ways? You know, it's not to say that that's maybe, you know, social dynamic or the particular, let me rather say the northern suburbs like that, you know, the sort of wealth, the alcohol, the parents' cabinets, the raiding, the parties. You know, it. Sorry, Bob, were you saying something there?
No, I just laughed.
Yeah, it resonates, right? A feel of growing up, right? What was it? You know, shoo. I mean, certainly, I think anyone who's grown up in Johannesburg, what was it growing up in Johannesburg? Like, well, man, like it was like iconic, right? You know, you look back on it as an adult, you look back at the wonder that we're actually still alive. I think so many of us, I'm sure, Bob, I'm listening for your laugh again, right? I'm sure that resonates with you. Like, how didn't we die though? We were so irresponsible. We got so fucked up and wasted, you know?
Yep. I have been in some very dangerous places on some very hallucinogenic drugs, you know?
You know, Bob, I think we need a 12-part podcast. Let's call that the Bobcast. episodic series to hear all those stories from you.
No, those will come out on stage in various parts of my career when it's safe to tell them.
Yeah. What do we call it? Off the record.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, big questions, existential questions, youth questions. What was it like for a particular segment? And in this film, it was a privileged segment in the northern suburbs, the characters of Sibs' story. But what was this born free upon this backdrop of apartheid that is still permeating our streets? You know, what is that? And I think, you know, how does our history, you know, our specific history, you know, unique to South Africa, just like one can ask in youth cultures in other cities, how does your history, how does that city, what is the backdrop that, you know, may drive youth to wastelessness, right? Wastefulness, yeah. To, you know, chaos, to death, to suicide, literally. I mean, that was the story. That was the exploration. That was the idea we're getting looked at.
And it's, I mean, it's so close to home, Bob. Exactly. If you're in the creative scene, like, you know someone who has taken their own life. Like, that's just, I mean, I know it happens in other parts of life as well, but it happens more to our friends. And that's why, like, I think that film really resonated with me, because it was something that, you know, like, we had gone through, and not necessarily in the ways shown in the film, but I appreciated the film taking that look at it.
And, you know, it's interesting, Bob, as you speak about that, you know, I think of my protagonist in Thorns, characters named Mbali, and just wonderfully portrayed by first-time actress Sisipho Mbombo. You know, what I was exploring there again is the precipice between life and death and suicide, and, you know, a character who changed her mind. And I think that's also really important anytime we are speaking about suicide as lived experiences, whom you, myself, so many of us also have survived. We've survived the loss of a loved one through their own hand. But it's very important to always bring around, you know, the opportunity, the conversation, as well, you know, the inherent value to life, you know, the inherent need for support and resources, you know, Bob, especially in this time, right? Especially in a pandemic where we are shrouded by grief like we've never known, death like we've never imagined, layer upon layer upon layer within an extraordinary global recession. The pressure
it can be hard to find meaning.
The pressure, you know, the pressure on young people as well. You know, even just trying to forge a career in this time. I can't even imagine.
What is a career at this point?
What is a career? I love that question. What is a life, right? What are we doing on a planet? Yeah. Love that question. But yes, I truly do believe there is an inherent gift and value to life. And there is always inherent connection between life and death. I'm so connected to my loved ones who've left. I live it, I breathe it, I connect with them every day. I see them in my life. I see them with me. You know, I feel them with me. But there is also
a time where I would not have understood that, but at this point in my life, I very much do. It's like the people who have died, like, are still there. Like, I still talk to them. You know, they still talk
absolutely.
Back. So,
oh, absolutely, Bob. And I truly hear you. The older I get, the more, shall we say, three-dimensional or multi-dimensional. Maybe we're in the seventh dimension here, it all becomes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, as you get older, you learn that, like, cynicism might not be the best way to move forward. And, definitely not a good segue. But basically, I guess Nectar Youth was some pretty cynical film in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I assume the work you create isn't. So how have you evolved, like, since then, like, as an artist?
You know, in so many ways, Nectar Youth and the character I portrayed was sort of an existential lover. That was, I think, actually in her character description. But yet for me, as an actor and a person, that role, that story, that film took me back to being 14 years old and the death of my friend.
Yeah.
And the character's emotional response to this was nothing like my own.
Okay.
Nothing. The work I create now, what I look at now, is how we may find in ourselves and be inspired through each other to create, lend, lean into balms, soothing balms for our broken hearts, for our broken stories. You know, we all carry them. How may we find meaningful integration and perhaps, Bob, even a vibrant vitality after all the trauma we've experienced in this life, and we're, you know, only however many years old we are, all the layers of grief and depression and dullness. Truly, Bob, how do we move from our vitality? What is it that I'm celebrating in works, you know, for my bigger, more long-term projects? Celebrating friendship, Bob, meaningful friendship. Friendship that survives decades of change. Friendship that sees us move through illusions of what our life might be, what a career is, what success looks like, what familial or religious expectations may surround us that we conform to in our conditioning, only to break down and be faced with, you know, a chasm of loss, anxiety, grief, all these, you know, very ever-present adults, you know, confronting emotions to say, wait, hang on, what is life? What is on the other side? How do we live this thing? How do we live this thing? What are we doing here? Who are we really? And the extraordinary love, personalities, people, tenderness, you know, tenderness that mental health can be looked at. Mental health issues seems to permeate my work in so many ways. And, you know, the tiniest, gentlest ways that people may integrate and find their meaning, their worthiness, their completeness in themselves and their reason to keep living, right? Their reason to choose the future, to choose that unknown. So, you know, really, I think my work takes the pain of much of what we live through in this crazy, modern, capitalist, technological world and reimagines through all the quirky nuance of quite out there characters who we might be or how we might reach the other side and find a little slice of peace.
Damn, that's... I wasn't expecting all of that, to be honest. And like, I guess, I mean, when I get to see more of your work, I'd love to. You've explained so much there that just makes me feel like I really, really need to watch like what you've got coming out. Because it sounds like you, but I know this about you, that you give a lot of consideration to character. Because when we've discussed screenwriting, that is something that you kind of expressed on me, and also motivations and stuff like that. So, yeah, I guess with time, that's something that's developed with you, was the ability to really see through so much more, I guess.
You know, I guess it's also extraordinary. We're all growing, right? Having made my first short film and now in the early development stages of my next, you know, writing. And this one's called Chasing Dopamine.
Oh, wow.
An oddball romantic comedy. You know, you watch yourself evolve, right? Your ability to understand the nuance of what is such a cosmic and collaborative process of film. How do we create character and story? How does this three-dimensionally take shape to two-dimensionally get projected in cinemas and on our TV screens at home? So it really is an intuitive, organic experience as well. We change, we absorb, we learn. We are learning creatures as human beings. We are absorbing beings. We don't stay the same.
Yeah, constantly evolving. There's not like, yeah, I wanted to get into something else there, but I actually need to quickly get into Patreon questions, because this podcast is brought to you by you, if you are listening, and not you, Italia. But yeah, So every week we offer patrons the opportunity to ask guest questions. And you're someone who has actually been requested via Patreon and also has a few questions by Simp Slayer, which is quite a name. I think we'll start off with, what are three things that you're optimistic about?
Ooh. Love, friendship, family. Those are my top three.
Pretty high up there.
Although one could say love, friendship, and family are all one, right?
Are the same thing. Yeah.
They're love. So is career. Everything is love. But work. Let me say work, not career. Work and health and wealth.
Okay. Which are also kind of the same thing.
Right? Yeah, they're all the same.
It's all love, baby. It's all love.
It's all love.
Yeah, they also ask, why in some of the films you've acted, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but they say, why in some of the films you've acted in, bad things happen to you, like in Unthinkable, As an Amali, Nectar, and Haunting of Maria Smith. So I think, like, why do you pick roles where bad things happen to you is probably a good question there. And how do you feel about those things happening?
Sure. What a delicate, tender question. I think I've been exposed to a lot of drama as a genre. I've been cast in a lot of drama genre. That rhymes. And, you know, I'd mentioned in the podcast about my latest role as Cassie in Sweet Wild Thing. This excitement about, you know, not having that heavy, dramatic, arduous experience. I think that there is a threshold of pain that I can hold, you know, that I've seen and in characters that I can portray. If that sort of answers that question about those particular genres of film.
Yeah, I get that. And I guess we touched on it earlier, just what the effects of that are on you when you're actually portraying them. Let's get into the next one because we've got a few questions here. You've got a fan here, like someone who really digs your work. They ask, hello. Which is your favorite billboard? Is console glass Karen or IEC registered to vote Puma? I don't know what these are, so I assume you do.
Okay, so you're missing one billboard. There's an Absa billboard with twin babies. Maybe, what were the three? Was console?
Well, the
glass?
Two was console glass Karen or IEC registered to vote Puma.
Maybe I just go straight with that IEC registered to vote. It's because it was a really cute portrait shot. And actually, I love the guys who, the production stills team, who were running that campaign. And we've actually come full circle this year and I've started to work together more from the other side of the cameras, POV. But I'm definitely going to go with that IEC campaign, first for the cuteness factor of the shot and for the team behind it, Neto and Paresh. Shout out.
Okay, sick. What part of your life do you feel you can control and how much of your life, what parts of your life do you feel you can control and how much of your life is beyond your control?
Sure.
I know.
Can we get a mathematician and a great scientist in the house?
I think it might just be like, what are the things you focus on and what are the things you let go?
Yeah. You know, both the things I let go, also it's only in my control to let go, right? When there's nothing I can control, the only thing I can do is let go. If something's hurting or bothering me or needing forgiveness, you know. But I guess, you know, one hopes to some degree, on some very frontal level of consciousness, we are in control of our actions or most of them most of the time. And I think it's important to think about control and what we can control also as a process, you know. We are all evolving when we want to change our thought patterns and we're working really hard, for example. You know, we're not losing the battle. We're actually winning as we struggle to make changes, to get more in control, to see the change we want. That's us doing it.
Okay. You've given me a lot to think about there because I struggle with, letting go. But you're actually saying that letting go actually has power.
You know, Bob, letting go has true power. I think karmically, it is incredibly important for us to be clearing chasms of whatever, you know, emotional residue, unresolved relating between people or energies, but you know, all we sit with is ourselves. These are debts we can continue to carry, weights we carry. I do mindfully think about what it is I would not want to bring back into other lifetimes, you know, and that's the power of letting go. Letting go is hard, but letting go is also a process. It is a practice. Just because you think I need to let go of this and you just feel as emotionally attached outside of your own control to it 1 second later doesn't mean you're not letting go of the thing. Letting go is incredibly, incredibly important, and it's not easy. So you're not alone, Bob.
Well, thanks. I'm glad I'm not alone. Sometimes feels like I am, you know, especially during the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, maybe you are.
maybe.
Yeah, maybe I'm not really here. Maybe I am a projection of you.
I've had to deal with that a lot. Like in the last year, talking to everyone through a computer screen and not even doing video, but I like it not being video. I like these vibes. Yeah. It allows people to be more comfortable and less performative, I find. Okay, so two more questions from them since we've been going. They ask, what moments in your life would you like to replay?
Ooh, replay. Happy moments and loving moments, that's for sure. Maybe when I sort of fell in love for some of the first times. Oh. Yeah. I'd like to replay falling in love before I turned 20. Those moments were different.
I can't relate. All the times I fell in love before 20 were bullshit. It was just me lying to myself.
Yeah. Oh, shame, Bob. But no.
But I found love. I found love later. I learned that love isn't just, you know, a pretty girl. Like,
no.
I used to think that if a girl was pretty, that I loved her. And I've learned so much since those days.
You know, well done. Well done, Bob. And I think we've all been learning a lot. People are such a wild pack, right? People are an entire pack of cards, but all we see is the front at the beginning. Got to take our time and get to know people.
And you also got to get rid of the jokers and the blank cards.
There's the comedian in the room.
Trust me, I would know better than anyone. Okay, then the last thing I guess I'll ask from them is one that relates to all of us, is will your films be on streaming platforms? Like, will Thorns be streamed at all, or what's the deal there?
So I can't release information about that yet, because currently we are in what will be about a year or two of film festivals before screening platforms.
Oh, sweet.
But then, yes, I do believe that we will be going on to SVODS channels, but more on that in a couple of years' time.
Yeah, that's, I guess people don't know the process with this stuff can be quite long, especially if it's funded and especially if you've got people who really want to make their money back. It's going to take a while before it gets on, the streaming platforms, because there's such a long process with all of it. But cool. They also ask you to follow them on Instagram. I'll send you their handle because I don't want to blow it up.
Thank you, Bob. Yes, please. Thank you.
But cool. Yeah. So that brings us to the end, I guess. Is there anything else you want to get off your chest?
You know, I just want to wish you a great day, man.
I mean, the rest of my day is just going to be spent editing this. So it's going to be quite chilled. I don't have a lot of stress in my life right now. So that's always a positive. And you, what you got going on? Because I know you're part of a writer's thing at the moment. I think, what are you doing? What are you part of? You're an incubator or a lab?
No, I'm not. I'm actually, it's very informal with as the DGI studio. I'm here right now. They've given me some space to be working on my next short film, which I mentioned earlier, Chasing Dopamine. So I'm actually here now, and it's lovely and warm, and I'm surrounded by art. And we've got in the next room printers working at the printer's press.
Oh, sick. Although that's not the most quiet space to be working in.
You know, I'm one of those people, Bob, that suits me very well. I love a bit of noise. I'm a coffee shop writer for sure.
Yeah.
It helps me focus. If people are busy around me, I can really just zone in. So it's definitely my vibe.
Yeah, for me, if people are busy around me, I can zone in because I want them to think I'm, you know, being productive. So I start being productive.
Cute. Whatever works, right?
Yeah, whatever works. Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. I do look forward to actually getting to see your films for myself and not just see you acting in other people's work. So either I'll catch it at the film festivals or at, you know, 2 years' time when it's on VOD.
Oh, looking forward to it, Bob. Looking forward to many more chats with you. I'm sure I'm going to be in Durban very soon too, possibly before month end, actually. So we could even make our own little audience, and you, me, and Paige can have our own screening of Thorns. How about that? That's actually such an idea.
Well, that'll be a vibe. Yeah, I'll be into that. So cool. We can do that. We can chat when you're coming down again. And yeah, that brings us to the end. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for the morning. It's been great, Bob.